Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 100. It's September 17th, 2020. While the Willie Express gained momentum, Willie's hired mad dog, Neil Reschen, was putting more and more of his time and energy into Waylon, no matter how the receipts were stacking up. Neil and Waylon were both different kinds of animals than Willie. Waylon was fixated on maintaining control in the studio. Long periods of time, locked in a room, were good for him and good for those around him. Working the old Chet Atkins system of 3 hours and you're out, or Willie's way of no more than two or three takes per track, was not Waylon's style. Waylon came perilously close to wiping out his career during the last week of August 1977, when agents from the Drug Enforcement Administration stormed Waylon's Nashville office and arrested him for cocaine possession. A package from Neil Reschen's office, sent via World Courier, Inc., had been intercepted before it reached Waylon's studio. Waylon's cocaine habit was hardly news around the music community, where a blizzard had been blowing for the past 3 years, just like it had been blowing in Los Angeles, New York, Austin, and all over America. Coke wasn't addictive, so the story went. Waylon later said he was personally snorting about a quarter ounce of coke a day, easily a $500-a-day habit. But Waylon dodged the bullet. He was never convicted, nor did time. The sender of the package, Mark Rothbaum, Neil Reschen's gopher, took the fall for him and went to jail for shipping the cocaine. It was a rude awakening. The outlaws weren't bulletproof. The real world had intruded on the fantasy. Willie fired Neil Reschen, so did Waylon, so did Miles Davis. For Willie, letting Mark go to jail was merely the tipping point. Neil was the kind of guy who demanded respect, even if he didn't earn it, just as he demanded attention for Willie and Waylon. But an unexpected $7,000 bill from the tax man put Neil's head squarely on the chopping block. Willie thought Neil had paid those taxes for him, but obviously he had not. Willie had fired Neil several times previously, once for the tax problem, once for his negativity. He cut the cord for good when Mark went to jail. "That never did sit right with me," Willie said. "I liked Mark. I admired him. I respected him. I knew he was sharp, young, and had lots of guts." Mark's former boss, Neil Reschen, knew the clock had run out on his relationship with Willie. "Our management philosophy was to make their deals and try to keep them going, doing their own work," Reschen said diplomatically. Willie liked that for the first 10 years, and then he decided he would become a businessman as well. Paul English, Willie's closest friend and financial advisor, felt it had been past time for a change. "Neil did a good job up to the point that he couldn't do it anymore," he said. "In 1972, when Neil came in, I hadn't filed income tax for 6 years because I wasn't making enough money to fool with it. Willie hadn't filed in 3 years. Neil negotiated with the IRS for Willie and for me. They settled with me for $6,000 for the entire 6 years. Then he did a good job for 3 or 4 years. I don't think he had the ability to respect the relationship we had at that time. Something else had taken over. We came to find out he wasn't a CPA, nor was he a CPA attorney. You're not supposed to be able to negotiate with the IRS unless you are a CPA attorney, but he did it successfully." Mark Rothbaum made the best out of his time, out of his jail time. He ran the prison newspaper, maintained a garden, and worked out religiously. Willie kept him hired while he was inside, stayed in touch, and played a benefit at the prison on Mark's behalf. "The warden was a big fan of Willie's," Mark said. "He let me use the telephone. A lot of the promoters came to see me, and that was that." His sentence was reduced from years to months. Upon Mark's release, Willie asked him to open an office to look after his interests. "Mark was honest," Willie said. "I wanted him out there to represent me without having a title. I didn't want a manager. I just wanted Mark to be out there." Miles did the same. Waylon came around a year later. "Waylon was a funny guy," Mark said, affirming again that he had a different relationship with Waylon than with Willie. "If he was nasty to you, not mad at you, you'd see him the next day and he'd go, 'How you doing, Hoss? Boy, I must have eaten something last night. I didn't feel well.' That's as good an apology as you were going to get from Waylon. If you understood Waylon speak, it was good enough." Willie was more direct. "Mark's a friend you can go to and say, 'Can you do this?'" he said of their relationship. "He's a friend who'll call me and say, 'Hey, I think you ought to do this,' and I can either do it or not do it. And he would say, 'Okay,' or argue with me a little. You can't buy a guy like that." That's a short passage I'm reading from Willie Nelson, An Epic Life, a biography written by Jonek Petoskey. It's fantastic. With this being episode 100, I wanted to go back to where we started, which is this book and Willie. Here's another part. Friendship kept Paul English and Willie together all these years. Willie said, "The kind you can't buy, that's not for sale. You know it when you see it. Paul is probably the best friend I got." Paul returned the compliment. "Willie is the main relationship I've had in my life. It started 51 years ago. He's a great entertainer and a great writer, and I'm proud of him for that. Mainly, though, he's my friend. He sometimes says I'm his best friend. I really appreciate him saying that because I know he means it, and I love him. He could get a far better drummer than me for half the price. The entertainment business is mentally tougher than the other businesses I've worked in. It takes more loyalty, and you don't get that much in a business unless it's Willie. I've been disappointed by a lot of people, but mainly because they can't measure up to Willie. Family is more than just blood, especially for me," Paul said. "We've been through so much together. The death of a father, the death of a son, the death of my wife, Carlene. When Carlene died, I went from 180 pounds to 130, and I was mean. I would really like to die, but he was there for me." Those around Willie learned to tolerate his eccentricities. It was standard operating procedure on Willie's bus to wait until he'd mentioned something a second or third time before taking him seriously. Otherwise, they'd be running around trying to carry out all orders all day, only to have the boss say, "What'd you do that for?" Mark Rothbaum spoke to him at least 5 times a day and otherwise looked after Willie's interests, especially whenever Willie said yes. "Willie can't say no," Mark said. He cited the time Brian Ahern, the producer and husband of singer Emmylou Harris, had persuaded Willie to buy the Enactron's truck studio, which recorded Stardust. When Ahern arrived one day before the scheduled signing of papers, Rothbaum was waiting for him in Willie's hotel room, ready to kill the deal. "When he saw me, he knew it wasn't going to happen," Rothbaum said. "The last thing Willie needed was another studio." Another time, Doug Holloway brought Willie a deal for a Willie Nelson credit card, and Willie signed an agreement with him before Mark intervened. "That's a very smart deal you made," Mark told Willie. "Really?" "Yeah, it's genius." "How can that be genius?" "Well, think about it. A third of all credit cards go into receivership, so a third of your fans will go bankrupt, and they'll have to look at your picture on that credit card. Every time they see your picture, they'll think, 'That prick is making money off of me.' You'll be making money off their credit card, so what you won't have a career. You'll be making money, and that's the important thing. It's a smart deal." Willie asked Mark to get him out of the agreement. It's just awesome reading some of this stuff. It's very character sketchy. I'm just hopping from, you know, vignette to vignette, but in the last century, you know, Willie's had as outsized an impact on Austin as anyone. He responded to something that was already here, so he didn't make it, but he sure helped make it happen, for which we all appreciate him. I'll pick up another story here. Oh, and also, too, it's just awesome to hear him and Paul talking about each other and kind of how Mark Rothbaum got into the mix and stuck around. This one, I think, is a little bit after Willie's famous IRS problems, huge tax bill. I won't go into all that. It's well told in this book. But here we go. Mike Tollison, a lawyer from the old Armadillo World headquarters, had introduced Willie to the Television Group, a business with extensive experience in television production and time buys. TVG paid Willie, meaning the IRS, an advance to market the tapes, along with the second album, The Hungry Years, of Willie's earliest recordings. A telemarketing operation was set up in Nashville with a bank of operators to process credit cards and a fulfillment center to process and ship orders. A television commercial was produced and legal clearances were negotiated. 4 months of saturation advertising on television, mostly late at night, generated sales of 160,000 copies, far short of the $4 million figure that was needed to erase Willie's debt. But Willie feigned hope. "You got to be positive," he said. "It's not unheard of. I could sell 3 million albums. I've done it before." The problem was the IRS tapes wasn't Stardust or Redheaded Stranger. The album was eventually released through traditional distribution channels and retail stores. But the idea of salvation through album sales was pretty much fell apart when the Television Group got it into its own financial straits and declared bankruptcy. "I spent many hours, days, and weeks dealing with the aftermath of that, including processing all the orders that had come in but were now in the pipeline waiting for fulfillment, attorney Mike Tollison said. There was inventory in Nashville, orders unfulfilled due to lack of payment to the fulfillment house, money tied up in bankruptcy, and Willie customers waiting for their records. Meanwhile, the IRS wanted answers, and the TVG business had claims and creditors lining up. Eventually, customers either got their record or got their money back. The album and the auctions of Willie's properties generated about $3.6 million, with Willie reportedly promising to pay another $5.4 million in the coming years on top of the nearly $8 million he had already paid for the periods in question. A settlement with Price Waterhouse was reached out of the public eye. According to several sources, the balance owed the feds was taken care of as one of the conditions of the settlement. In spite of his relatively straightforward attempt to resolve his debt, a perception lingered that Willie was a tax dodger. None of that was true, Mark Rothbaum said. Willie had the option of bankruptcy and chose not to use it. He wasn't so much stubborn as honest, and he no more believed in setting aside his tax obligations than he did personal bills. He wasn't going to choose to use that as an option. So we fought the hard fight, and it was very creative and stressful, and at the same time, it took up so much of our time that music was really all we had. The debt was officially settled in 1993. Evelyn Shriver was on the conference call that made it official. I'd ended up working with quite a few people in that department at the IRS, and they were all crying. These people loved Willie, too. Everybody's heart broke for him in that situation. When it came to a resolution everybody could live with, they cried. They were happy because it was over. His stubbornness got him in trouble, but it also got him out of it, Willie's cohort, Kinky Friedman, believed. He's made the point to me that one of the things he's prided himself in since he was a child was getting himself into trouble and then getting himself out of it. He's done it his whole life, and this was trouble. He didn't do it the easy way and plead bankruptcy. He did it the cowboy way. But in the end, the IRS loved Willie. Classic. Classic. And, you know, Mark Rothbaum coursing in and out. I'm going to find some background and bios on him alone. Love to know how he even showed up and a little more about it. Here's a little longer stretch about Willie and movies. Honeysuckle Rose, which opened in theaters across America 3 weeks after Willie's 1980 Fourth of July picnic at the Pedernales Country Club, had confirmed Willie's cinematic career had legs. He responded by making movies like he made records. Over the next 5 years, he did a cameo before being killed off in Thief, a 1981 hard-boiled drama about a safecracker working for the mafia, written by Michael Mann that starred James Caan, Tuesday Weld, Dennis Farina, Robert Prosky, and James Belushi. Played the role of Red Loon, an American political prisoner in Siberia in the 1920s, in the 1982 made-for-television true story Coming Out of the Ice, and played an outlaw who'd seen better days as the lead in the 1982 film Barbarossa, a stark western set in Mexico that also starred Gary Busey and Gilbert Roland. Co-produced and written by Bill Whitliff, an Austin screenwriter who was working with Willie to make a movie based on Redheaded Stranger, Barbarossa was filmed on the banks of the Rio Grande in the desert west of Big Bend National Park for $13 million. Gary Busey's character is a farmer forced to take up the life of a gunslinger, a trade he learns from Willie's character, Barbarossa. While making the movie, Willie played a gig to raise funds to buy a resuscitator for the Big Bend Regional Hospital. Country music again provided the backdrop for songwriter, the 1984 Willie and Chris buddy movie that, like Honeysuckle Rose, was inspired by real life. Willie assumed the role of Doc Jenkins, a songwriter turned music mogul. When he gets into a bad business deal, he seeks out his former singing partner, Blackie Buck, played by Kris Kristofferson, to help him. The character I was playing was originally written for Waylon, Chris said. We had a real good director, Alan Rudolph, who was open to creative stuff right on the set. We would make up whole scenes. He got the joke. He would allow us the freedom to try something, then make a suggestion so we would do it better. There's a scene where I wake up in bed with an eye mask on. He said, walk over to the mirror and look at yourself with the eye mask still on. I went over and did it, and when I did it, I thought of my crew chief when I was working in the Gulf of Mexico, flying helicopters to offshore oil rigs. Every morning he looked in the mirror and say, you good-looking thing, don't you never die. I said that with the eye mask on. Alan Rudolph said, perfect. Joining Willie and Chris was Leslie Ann Warren, playing the up-and-coming singer who becomes his co-conspirator. Rip Torn based his CD bad guy character, Dino McLeish, on Gino McCausland. Musicians Mickey Raphael, B. Spears, Jody Payne, Paul English, Bobby Nelson, Johnny Gimble, Grady Martin, and Jackie King, and associates Pootie Locke, Gates Moore, Larry Trader, Larry Gorham, B.C. Cooper, and Steve Fromholtz all had parts. So did KVET disc jockey Sammy Allred. There was a scene where I was playing the part of a disc jockey, and Willie asks if I take payola. Sammy said. I said, you bet. Mickey Raphael actually got some speaking lines acknowledging all of his tall, dark, and handsome stature and his Hollywood proclivities. Los Angeles had become his new home base when he wasn't on the road, which led to album and movie work, including three albums with Emmylou Harris, the underrated soundtrack for the film Blue Collar, scored by Jack Nitzsche, and also featuring Captain Beefheart and Ry Cooder, and a five-year relationship with the actress Ally McGraw. Willie's love affair with the camera extended to the HBO special with Ray Charles into participating in Michael Jackson's We Are the World, superstar recording session for Jackson's USA for Africa project in 1985, which was filmed. He and Kenny Rogers were the voices of country music on the project, orchestrated by Jackson, who at the time ruled the airways as the king of pop. He also appeared in the 1983 historical documentary about the Californian motorcycle gang Hell's Angels Forever, alongside head angel Sonny Barger and musicians Jerry Garcia, Bo Diddley, and Johnny Paycheck. Did a cameo on Pryor's Place, comedian Richard Pryor's 1984 Kitty television series, and was cast in 1986's The Last Days of Frank and Jesse James, alongside Christofferson, Marsha Cross, and June Carter Cash, with David Allan Coe playing a bit part. He had his own bit part in the Roger Corman B-movie, Amazon, playing the good wizard who leads the Amazons before he is killed off, and he sang the title song in the 1988 HBO movie of Dan Jenkins, Baja, Oklahoma, starring his friend Leslie Ann Warren. He played opposite Delta Burke and Jack Elam in the 1988 Burt comedy-directed TV Western movie Where the Hell's That Gold, which was filmed in Southern Colorado, was a credible bad guy in the 1988 CBS network film Texas Guns, and also directed by Burt Kennedy, and did two made-for-television movies playing a lovable safecracker pursued by Kris Kristofferson and Rip Torn's Texas Ranger characters in Pair of Aces and Another Pair of Aces, written by Austin writers Bud Schrake and Jap Cartwright, which aired in 1990 and 1991, respectively. As long as movies didn't interfere with his main line of work, he was always good to go for a turn in front of the camera. Making movies never took over 30 or 40 days, and sometimes only 7 or 8 days to do the parts, Willie said. It never got in the way of the music. It was just something to do that was a lot of fun. I don't think he took movies seriously, his financial advisor Mark Rothbaum said. He's Willie. I don't think he's particularly thrilled to sit around and wait all day. He does it in his off times. Willie didn't want to do Wag the Dog, so I said fine. He was going to be the band in it, and I asked for the bigger role of Johnny Gray, and they said okay. I got them haggard for the band instead, so everything's set, and Willie says, I don't want to do it. So I say, great, do you mind if I offer Cash the role? It's too good of a role to give up. So he says to me, I said I didn't want to do it. I didn't say I wasn't going to do it. He was so loved on that set. He's the best third guy in the business, Rothbaum believed. If you're a director and a producer and you have a role that you need a third fella for, get Willie. He's the best guy on a set, especially with temperamental artists, because the crew loves him. The actors love him. It's a party. The bus becomes a great place. He's just like Dean Martin. Movie Money helped underwrite construction of a second studio, the 24-track Arlen Studios, adjacent to the main room of the Austin Opry House, operated by his nephew, Freddie Fletcher. The studios led to a glut of Willie product, which worried Mark Rothbaum. I had to adopt a mindset that all the albums were good in his career when I privately knew it wasn't. At the same time, there were people at the record companies who earned money through billing, so four records at once from their hottest artists may not be good long term, but these record executives weren't there for the long term. They were going to be there until they made their money and could retire, which is in fact what happened. They would welcome more records, even though they, too, did not believe it was best for his long-term career. No one spoke up about Willie being overexposed other than Colonel Tom Parker, who had opined that no way would he let Willie play some as much as he was playing, not if the Colonel were running the show. And Bruce Lundvall of Columbia Records. I had to tell him to stop, Bruce said. There were too many Willie Nelson records. I told him he'd lose his special attraction. He wouldn't listen, but he was such a sweet man. You know, fun, brilliant. I mean, it's just a long list, like Internet Movie Database of all the stuff he was doing, movie-wise. But, you know, hearing names like Bud Schrake and Bill Whitliff and Christofferson and all of that, and even little wag the dog moments, and Mark Rothbaum there again, advising, just really brilliant stuff. I love all of it. And I don't know, Willie's in his 80s. We need to keep that spirit alive here. We need to find and celebrate artists and entrepreneurs and everybody making this place distinctive, and contributing to it. I'm going to back up here for one more reading, and it's the earliest in the timeline from these so far. Austin was meant to be. Willie didn't need to consult Astara or reread Gibran to feel the vibes. Sister Bobby was finding steady work at Lakeway, a posh country club community on the shores of Lake Travis, and several of her old piano bar haunts. For the first time since Fort Worth, Bobby and Hudie were both enjoying careers in music in the same town. Even if he failed, and he didn't think like that or put up with those who believed failing was an option, he could at least afford to. The living was easy in Austin. It didn't take much to get by. Garage apartments in Hyde Park and Old West Austin rented for well under $100 a month. A six-pack of Texas Pride went for 99 cents. An ounce of good commercial marijuana sold for 10 bucks. LSD and peyote were plentiful. It was a UT Austin student who first synthesized mescaline from peyote. The weather was warm, the winters mild, and good times were no farther than Barton Springs, Lake Austin, and Lake Travis. The new culture welded the hedonistic attributes of the hippie lifestyle, drugs and sex especially, onto the body of a Texas redneck. Real rednecks and hippie rednecks both loved pickups and both liked to drive while drinking, a long neck held between their legs, totally legal in the eyes of Texas law, as long as they weren't drunk. Both liked hanging in clubs and hearing music, and both liked getting high and howling at the moon just for the hell of it. With Paul watching his back, B at his side, Jimmy Day reentering the picture, and friends and family all around him, Willie was sitting in the catbird's seat. Billy Ray Cooper, BC, came up from San Antonio and moved in with Willie and Connie and their brood to split shifts driving the band's open road camper with Jack Fletcher. BC quickly discovered that his former career driving ambulances might be a safer line of work. Jack was behind the wheel of the open road on the way back to Lost Valley after a show in Llano in the Hill Country. The sound was full of twists and tight curves, and the camper had clearly seen better days. "You could stick your finger through the plywood," BC said. Willie and Paul were in the back playing poker when Jack suddenly shouted, "Will, the brakes are going. What are we going to do?" "Deal the cards," Willie shouted back. Somehow the open road limped back home. BC became Willie's personal driver when Willie bought an old Mercedes sedan from Bill McMorris, the Austin car dealer he met through Daryl Royal. McMorris also got the band a Blazer to haul their gear, which B. Spears drove. "If we could pay expenses and everybody got $100 after a gig, everything was fine," BC said. Tim O'Connor signed on shortly after he met Willie one night at the door of Castle Creek, the Austin club he was co-managing. "He walked in and asked for me and introduced himself. I said, 'Sir, I know who you are.' He said he wanted to play my joint, so I asked him what he was drinking," Tim said. They went back to a little office couch where there was a cooler with some beer, and we became friends right there. Over the course of a few weeks, Tim informed his partner, Doug Moyes, "You can have the club. I'm going with Willie." Tim knew enough about the club and concert business to think he could help Willie upgrade his show. He began to travel with the band and demand better sound and better treatment wherever Willie was booked. At Gillies in Pasadena near Houston, a regular stop for Willie for years, Tim got crosswise with Sherwood Cryer, who owned the Massive Honky Tonk, when he informed Sherwood that Willie was canceling unless a decent sound system was brought in to accommodate Willie's new and improved show, and better security was provided to protect the band from the often rowdy crowd. "That was not something you said to Sherwood, especially not at Gillies, and you sure as hell didn't do it when they didn't know who the hell you are and had never seen you before," explained Tim. "Plus, Willie wanted the gig." Sherwood provided better sound, but security was non-existent. "Cowboys kept walking up on the stage while Willie was playing, which didn't bother Willie, but really bothered me," said Tim, who bitched about it loudly to anyone within range of his voice. It was raining as Willie and Tim walked out to Willie's red Mercedes for the drive home. Tim was carrying Willie's guitar and still complaining about the sound and the cowboys climbing on stage. "Damn it, what do you want me to be?" he fumed to Willie, after Willie treated it like no big deal. Willie turned around and his eyes turned black. the way they do when he's angry, Tim recalled. He said, I'll tell you three things I never want you to be. Cold, wet, or hungry. There was dead silence on the drive back to Austin. As they got out of the vehicle, Tim told Willie, I'll follow you to hell. I'll carry your guitar case to wherever. Willie called Tim the next day. You did a really good job, he told him. But I think you're a little bit ahead of us. Why don't you lay back a little until we get caught up? It was a polite firing, but Tim never went away. I could just go on and on and on. I could read the entire book. All those little nuggets are so awesome. Tim O'Connor stuck around for a long, long time and did lots of other things in Austin. Really helped live music. I don't know how any of such people are making it right now. The COVID shutdowns being what they are. I think many of them, in fact, aren't making it and aren't going to make it. We've already lost Threadgills, for example. Right now, it feels a bit like a friend who's passed away that you weren't used to seeing all that much anyway, so you can almost forget that they're gone until you think of them and checking in with them. I don't drive by Threadgills right now. There's still semi-quarantine stuff all over. But when I'm up North Lamar in a year or two and drive by the spot and it's condos, it's going to be incredibly disappointing. So we got to figure it out. The next time I come to this book, I think there's some just incredible stuff about, I mean, the IRS story alone is great, vivid. And also the story of Willie's first picnic, the armadillo crew helps a little bit. But the first picnic, and around that time too, the story of Billy Joe Shaver and Waylon Jennings and Honky Tonk Heroes is just a classic. So I hope Austin and Texas, I'm confident that Austin and Texas will keep appealing to artists and all of this, this great spirit, this wonderful atmosphere won't be crushed or simply fade. But of course, it's up to us. Thanks for the listening along the way so far. And I'll talk with you again tomorrow.